Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE.
And I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer. SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting.
Than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience.
With Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win.
Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Pranks are a legendary part of college life across the country. You may have heard about the time UW-Madison seniors covered their campus quad with 1,000 plastic flamingos as a going-away present. Or when Georgia Tech's mascot, a 1930 Ford Model A, was stolen multiple times. But one campus, one you might not expect, has a very specific prank culture of its own. One which has books written about it, websites dedicated to it, one which has become legendary, not just on campus, but across the region. This is the story of one of those pranks. On the morning after Halloween 1979, residents of Boston woke up to find a fiberglass cow named Bessie standing proud on top of MIT's Great Dome, some 300 feet in the air. Just 1 week earlier, the cow had been standing guard in front of the iconic Hilltop Steakhouse. This is the story of how Bessie lost her way. I'm Ian Mont. This week on Campus Files, Bessie on the Dome. US Route 1 runs along the Atlantic coast. It passes through Boston and runs up through a suburb called Saugus. If you drove that stretch of Route 1 in the 70s, you'd be dazzled by monuments to American kitsch.
There are dinosaurs here. And a cactus as tall as a dinosaur. A leaning tower of pizza.
If on your drive you wanted to stop for some food, you've got lots of options. You looking for pizza? Well, stop at Prince's. It's very easy to find. Just look for the 40-foot-tall replica Leaning Tower of Pisa. It says pizza in big red letters on the side. If you want Asian food, stop at the puzzlingly tiki-themed Kowloon restaurant. If you want steak, look for the herd of giant fiberglass cows guarding Hilltop Steakhouse. But good luck getting a seat at Hilltop. In the 70s, it was the busiest restaurant in America.
Frank Jafrida's Steakhouse was sort of a urban famous mafia hangout. There were probably 300 or 400 seats in that place.
That's Larry Cater. In 1979, Larry was a senior studying chemical engineering at MIT. And Hilltop Steakhouse was a quick half-hour drive north of campus. It was founded in 1963 by Frank Jafrida, and it quickly became iconic.
It was also the kind of place that you went when your parents came into town because you couldn't afford to go any other way.
It was on one of those visits that Larry had an idea. It centered around that herd of fiberglass cows just outside the restaurant.
It was a joint idea with one of my pals who was playing hockey out in Saugus. And I had been to the steakhouse a couple of times. And he mentioned that, you know, I passed by that big steakhouse and they've got a herd of cows on the front lawn. And I said, gee, I've always wanted one of those.
He wanted one of those cows, and he was determined to get one. Then, in October of his senior year, Larry had his chance.
I was the IM cycling chairman, which basically means I organize a yearly road race. And part of that was to have a van to bring bikes back from the destination. And so I had a van that MIT had paid for. We had a free night before the road race, so we schemed a way to go and take the cow.
So 1 week before the race, Larry and a friend drove up Route 1 to case the restaurant.
We had reconnoitered what the traffic was like at 2 o'clock in the morning a week or so before. One of the guys had a car, and so we had driven out there. We established that cars were pretty infrequent along that route. We didn't want to get immediately flagged by police doing something stupid.
Now, with some confidence he wouldn't be immediately busted, Larry recruited some of his fraternity brothers. He was a member of Alpha Tau Omega, or ATO.
I'm assuming the statute of limitations has expired because presumably that would have been some form of felony theft.
That's Aaron Bobek. Aaron was a junior computer science and math student at MIT and an ATO brother.
I'll freely admit to having been part of the initial crew that temporarily liberated the fiberglass cow.
So on a night in late October 1979, the team assembled. They split between the rented truck and Aaron's car.
So we had driven out there. It's probably a half an hour, 45-minute drive from Cambridge. We didn't know what we were going to find when we got there because we had just looked at things.
There were four ATO brothers that night. Larry, Aaron, and two others. One was put on guard duty, while the other three approached their target.
And so we had three of us to kind of hop over the fence and try and lift the cow up.
Larry and Aaron were both on cow duty, and almost immediately they ran into a problem.
It is the case that driving past it, you do not appreciate the magnitude of the size of this thing. I don't think we'd actually walked up close to it. So when we got there, it was sort of impressive.
The cow was probably 6 feet from nose to tail, and the head itself was about as big around as my head and shoulders were. We hadn't tried to lift the cows up or anything like that. Come to find out that it had cement feet on it.
Not only was their target absolutely massive, she was bolted into cement footings, holding her to the ground.
The thing that made it heavy was not so much the weight of the cow, but that it refused to be separated from the cement footings that were attached to the feet of the cow.
Oh, I would guess it was probably 300 or 400 pounds. And some of that was concrete.
But this was their only night with the truck. It was now or never.
I do think we were somewhat adrenaline fueled, so we may have had our greater than typical strength.
I was underneath the neck and was the one to first lift the feet free of the ground. And then we rocked it back and forth some other way and eventually got it so all four legs were free of dirt and whatever had been put there. And the other two people were at the back. We just lifted it up from the ground.
They carefully loaded the cow into the back of the truck and headed home.
For whatever reason, we thought we were so clever. We decided not to go down Route 1 because we thought that the chance that there would be police there of some sort was higher. And so we took some back roads, which really just meant that we were on roads for longer than we should have been with this cow and probably increased the likelihood of getting pulled over as opposed to decrease.
They safely arrived back at the ATO house. All they had to do was get this 6-foot-tall, 300-pound cow into the basement. It was easier said than done, but Larry had some experience with tricky maneuvers.
I had done some time as a mover, summer job kind of thing, and so I had some idea of how you had to navigate around steps. It had a landing and then a right angle turn. And so we just stood her up. And then there were a lot more than four people that were involved once we were moving it down into the basement.
Now living in the ATO house, the cow was given a name, Bessie. And she settled in quickly, maybe a little too quickly.
You don't really appreciate the scale of this thing until you get it. I think there was a general presumption that once we got in the house, what a cool thing to keep in the house, until we sort of saw the geometry.
I mean, it's always tough adjusting to new roommates, especially when that roommate is a giant fiberglass cow.
I would say after 3 or 4 days, it was a problem.
Bessie shared the space with a combo pool and ping pong table.
the ping pong players were starting to get very antsy. And so after 3 or 4 days, this has got to come to a head. I was the owner of the cow. I had to do something with it. And I didn't want to just put it out on Memorial Drive and be done.
Unfortunately, Bessie had become a problem. But they didn't have a truck anymore, so they couldn't quite return her. So, as often happens in a fraternity, a brilliant idea surfaces. An idea that involves the Great Dome, perhaps the most iconic building on MIT's campus. But getting a 300-pound fiberglass cow 300 or 400 feet off the ground and on top of the dome is no simple task.
June is here, which means it's finally time to reach for your summer wardrobe. And if you're trying to look good without overheating, Quince is your best bet. Their summer collection has all the warm weather staples: breathable linen, washable silk, and soft organic cotton. I now own their 100% linen pants in more colors than I'd like to admit. And the best part is that you get all that quality without the luxury markup. Everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're paying for quality, not brand markup. And it's not just clothing. Quince has become a destination for elevated essentials across the home, from kitchen to bedding, making it easy to bring a more premium feel into everyday life. Elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/campus for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/campus for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/campus.
Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history-telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade from the 18th century to the 20th. Original music and immersive sound design accompany us on our storytelling journey. Listen to and follow History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In late October 1979, the ATO frat house had a new tenant, Bessie, a giant fiberglass cow. But in less than a week, the fraternity realized they needed to kick her out. So when someone suggested putting her on top of MIT's famous Great Dome, the idea quickly gained steam. Now, if you didn't go to MIT, this probably sounds insane. And it is, but it's less insane than you might think.
Good hacks always had some sense of humor to them. Hacks, by definition, would not be condoned by people like myself, currently as a dean of engineering.
That's Aaron Bobek. He's talking about hacks, a term used to describe a long history of audacious, unsanctioned pranks on MIT's campus. But the term prank, while accurate, doesn't quite capture it. Here's Larry Cater.
It's definitely a prank, but it is thought of as more of a commentary than just a prank. There is a formal definition, and I'll do the best that I can with it, but it basically is something that is a wry look at what is going on in culture and is generally a non-destructive thing that is perpetrated in plain sight.
It's hard to say what or when the first hack was, but they at least went back to the early 1900s. In the 30s, a group of 5 students, including a future dean of MIT, welded a streetcar to its metal rails by distracting the driver and setting off small thermite bombs to weld the wheels in place.
And you could also do hacks to other groups. You know, you could rig up stink bombs and put them down the smokestack of places that had offended you.
And as you'd expect from MIT students, hacks are often technical or vaguely scientific.
There were various strange events like Baker House, which is a big dormitory on campus, throwing a piano off of the top of the roof and measuring the volume that it displaced in the ground. So that certainly was not a non-destructive hack. And some of them were just finding a weird place in the infrastructure of MIT that you could shimmy into, sort of like cave exploring. and then writing your name on the wall.
And as it turns out, cows have long been a key part of hacks. In 1928, a group of students walked a live cow up to the roof of a dorm on campus. And because cows can walk up, but not downstairs, she had to be tranquilized and hauled out. ATO has its own history of hacks, especially ones on Halloween night.
ATO had done several things on Halloween in the 60s. They had made the Great Pumpkin appear on the dome at MIT by using orange cells over the searchlights, hanging sheets, and painting a jack-o'-lantern face.
So if you're an ATO brother who needs to get rid of your new roommate, Bessie the cow, and Halloween just so happens to be about a week away, then putting Bessie on the dome isn't just a solution to your problem. It suddenly seems like a good idea. Here's Larry.
We started casting about for how it was going to happen. If Halloween was on a Friday, then probably by Wednesday afternoon or Thursday, we had a tentative plan, volunteers to go up in the dome and do some mountaineering were established.
One of the ATO brothers, named Mike, knew of an access panel from the engineering library, which sat under the Great Dome. That access panel led to an elevator mechanical room, which just so happened to have access to the top of the dome. Here's Aaron.
I think it was Mike who said we could get on top of the dome, and some other folks said, look, we'll walk the cow up to the roof, and then you guys will lower a rope or something, and we'll just pull it up.
So the teams were assembled, and a plan formed. Well, Aaron says calling it a plan is generous.
It may be extreme to say that it was a plan. Again, you're giving us way too much credit. Basically, there was a lot of spontaneity in all of this.
Either way, there were two teams. The ground team, which included Larry and a crew of other ATO brothers. They'd be responsible for getting Bessie in place for the lift. The dome team would consist of Mike and Aaron. They'd be responsible for lifting and placing Bessie. The plan had four phases. Phase one, get the dome team in place. So on Halloween night, Aaron and Mike packed a climbing rope and went to the engineering library, where they camped out until closing time.
We had to get into the library while it was still open and hide out. And then they closed it. And this was hours, hours before they brought the cow. I mean, the library was not open all night, so they closed it. So what time is a reasonable library closing time? You know, 10 o'clock? I have no idea.
The dome crew was now in place and had evaded detection as the library was closed for the night. Phase one was complete. Now for phase two, get Bessie in place. This phase is a bit more complicated and requires an understanding of the dome, which would be Bessie's new home. The Great Dome is on the very top of what MIT creatively named Building 10. It's a big building. From the front, you'll see a tall, probably four-story limestone structure. Massachusetts Institute of Technology is carved into a limestone face, supported by Greek-style pillars. The top of the building is mostly flat, but at the center of the roof is a circular platform, some 30 or 40 feet tall. On top of that platform is the giant 100-foot-wide Great Dome. The ground team's objective is to get Bessie onto that lower roof, just under the platform on which the dome rests, because directly under that dome is the Barker Engineering Library, where Aaron and Mike are in position. So the ground crew began phase two. Here's Larry.
So it was a 10-minute walk normally, and so if we did it in a half an hour carrying a 150-pound cow, that would probably be about usual. I don't remember what the moon situation was, but I remember the walk along Mem Drive being pretty dark. We didn't meet any campus policemen or any of that sort of stuff. And we just walked down and into the courtyard of the Great Dome and then found an open door, which in those days was not hard.
The first part of phase two had gone smoothly. Larry could feel the anticipation building.
We didn't want to get found out before we had do what we set out to do. We didn't want to have to abandon the cow because it was our cow. And certainly we were excited that this great idea had been dreamed up by the hive mind of ATO, and we were making it a reality and following in the footsteps of our forebears and all that sort of stuff.
Now that Bessie was inside Building 10, they just had to get her to the roof. So they found an unused stairwell.
Possibly there were people that were kind of sent out ahead to make sure there wasn't any janitor or other traffic that would call the wrath of God down on us, but it was pretty uneventful.
Once at the top of the stairwell, they encountered a locked door. Behind that door is the lower roof, the one that had the platform and the dome on top of it. Luckily, they were prepared.
Well, I will not name names, but there were people that had summer jobs that allowed them to have keys to physical plant spaces. And in the normal way of things, those keys kind of came to still reside with them. And then from time to time, they'd be passed down from an older person to a younger person.
With key in hand, they got access to the rooftop. While the ground crew got Bessie in position on the roof, Aaron and Mike were climbing up the dome. Here's Aaron.
There was just an access panel between sort of the public part of the library and the mechanical part of the library. You're supposed to go in through a door that's locked, but there was an access panel that for some reason, I don't know why it existed, and B was unlocked, I don't know why it was unlocked, and C, Mike knew about it, and I don't know why he knew about it. But you put all those things together, we could just basically crawl through this access panel into the mechanical part. That's the part that services the elevators and other kinds of things. And it has a door out to the dome.
Both teams were finally in place. Phase 2 was complete. Now was time for phase 3. Bessie on the dome. This phase is dead simple, but probably most risky. They needed to attach a rope to Bessie and lift her another 40 feet or so to the circular platform where Mike and Aaron would carry her by hand to the top of the dome. Here's Larry on the ground crew.
They signaled us and dropped the rope down and tied it on. We had to have a pretty ad hoc series of how we tied it up. I had some experience tying knots and knew something about ropes and lifting things and that kind of jazz. But the first time we hauled it up, then the knots came undone.
The crew nearly dropped Bessie on the final and riskiest part of her journey. But thankfully, she wasn't high enough to do any damage. So they refastened the knots and tried again. Here's Aaron on the dome crew.
The way it works is this kind of walkway around the dome with a wall in front of it, and you're leaning over that. One person would pull, and the other person would hold onto the rope behind them. So this way we had two sets of hands on the rope, which also provided safety for the person in the front doing the pulling.
With this setup, they managed to get Bessie all the way up. On the very tip of the Great Dome is a flat, circular skylight, which lights the library during the day. The dome crew placed Bessie on the skylight. Before leaving, they attached a note written on an IBM punch card. The note read something along the lines of, "I lost my way from Hilltop Steakhouse. Please return to owner."
They got it all the way to the pinnacle of the dome. They attached the note, and then we were all done. All of us standing around the base were, you know, high-fiving and saying, "Isn't this cool? And aren't we really something?"
But they weren't done quite yet. They had the fourth and final phase to complete, the escape. For the ground crew, phase 4 was easy. They just went back down the stairs and walked 10 minutes back to the ATO house where they could celebrate. It was more complicated for Mike and Aaron.
So we go back to the ladder, you go into a door, and you're into the mechanical area. Well, you would go to the hatch to go out to the main library, but those doors are locked. We evaluated our option, and I'm pretty sure it was not me who decided, because remember, I think Mike was the mountain climber. I think it's his rope. I think it's he that suggested we could rappel down the elevator shaft to the elevators. And I, like a numbnut, said, "Sure, why not?"
So Mike and Aaron got in touch with a member of the ground crew who would ride the elevator up to the fourth floor, just below the mechanical room.
They would then freeze the elevator, push stop on the elevator. Then we would climb down so that we could get in through the ceiling hatch of the elevator.
Mike and Aaron carefully rappelled down the elevator shaft. landing on top of the elevator car. They got the emergency hatch open and climbed inside, and it seemed that they were home free.
We went down to the first floor, then we were happy. All the dangerous part was done.
But crucially, none of them knew that the elevators had been subject to hacks of their own.
I think somebody had sort of been reprogramming, you know, so that you'd press one button and it would go some other floor. So we learned this, obviously, later.
And they were blissfully unaware that the elevators were under surveillance, possibly due to these hacks.
And then we literally opened the door, and there's the campus police.
I hear a lot from people that there are days where it's hard to read a single news story. Forget actually being caught up. But I host a podcast that can fix that. It's called The Seven. Seven stories every weekday by 7 a.m. Eastern. And here's the other thing. It's short, less than 10 minutes, in fact. I'm Hannah Jewell. The Seven podcast will turn around your morning and get you caught up. Check it out and follow The Seven wherever you listen to podcasts.
The four-phase operation of getting Bessie on top of the Great Dome had gone off almost without a hitch. At the very last second before escape, the Dome team was caught when the elevator door opened, revealing campus police. Fortunately, it seemed the police didn't know about Bessie yet.
They had no idea that anything more than somebody holding the elevator had happened. They were pretty relaxed about the whole thing. They said, were you guys fooling around in the elevator? And they said, are you all MIT students? We said, yes. We said, okay, give us your IDs. So we just gave them our IDs. And they said, you know, campus police chief will call you in the morning.
Mike, Aaron, and another one or two ATO brothers who had helped with the elevator escape headed back to the ATO house to await their fate. Early the next morning, Bessie was found.
The news had picked it up, and there were helicopters flying over and pictures going out over the airwaves, and it made the front page of the Globe and I don't know what else.
With helicopters buzzing over campus, the small group of busted ATO brothers went to see the MIT chief of police.
Well, he just told us that he was commuting into work, and he hears on the radio, the traffic copter says, it looks like there's a cow on the top of the MIT dome. And I believe he said something like he almost wet himself laughing. And he basically kind of let it go. And I don't even remember if he said, you know, don't do things like that again, but he didn't have to. But it all worked out pretty well. There were no sanctions.
Feeling invincible after meeting with the police, Mike and Aaron walk outside to see their handiwork. Unfortunately, there was already a crane being set up to hoist Bessie off the dome. But there was a TV crew set up to capture it. Mike and Aaron wandered over. One of the crew members asked if they knew anything about it.
Yeah, we were trying to be so cool and coy. We said, well, we would imagine that if it were being done, that this is how it might be done.
Mike and Aaron were interviewed for a story, which broadcast on the 6 p.m. news later that night. But for Aaron, that wasn't what mattered.
You know, it's funny. The whole TV thing, I don't want to say it was anticlimactic, but that was not the big deal. The big deal is that we had done it. I do remember being bummed that they got it off the roof so early.
By 9 or 10 a.m., Bessie was back on solid ground. While Mike and Aaron had been caught by campus police, Larry wasn't. Well, not by MIT.
My mother called me at about 10 o'clock the next morning to ask if I had anything to do with this, to which I had to say yes, because they knew that I had some sort of designs on the Frank Jafrida's steakhouse cows for a while.
Bessie made her way back to Hilltop Steakhouse, where she was cheerfully welcomed home by Frank, the owner of Hilltop.
My buddy who worked there said that that was one of the best pieces of advertising that Frank ever had, was to have it taken to MIT and then returned to him.
Frank was quick to take advantage of the press. He made a special graduation cap for Bessie, tassel and all. Bessie's time on the dome was one of the first in a long string of dome-related hacks. In the 90s, a replica MIT police car, complete with a box of Dunkin' Donuts, was placed on the dome. In another hack, it was draped with cloth to resemble Captain America's shield. The culture of hacks has only grown at MIT. It even has its own section in the MIT handbook. As for Larry and Aaron, They both graduated and went on to have successful careers of their own, and have both visited campus in the years since. Aaron recalls one particular visit to the MIT Museum where something jumped out at him.
I noticed there's a display, and all of a sudden there was the cow. And in fact, the picture that shows better picture of Mike and not great picture of me, that picture is on the description. It doesn't have our names. It just has the date that it happened.
Bessie's brief time on the dome was part of the MIT Museum, and it turns out there was more than just the photo. While Bessie was returned home to Saugus, she wouldn't stay there forever.
A final roundup at the Hilltop Steakhouse. The iconic restaurant officially closes its doors this evening, but not before customers give it a rousing send-off.
In 2013, Hilltop Steakhouse closed permanently. It was no longer the most visited restaurant in America. And after closing, memorabilia from the restaurant was auctioned off. But not included in the auction was Bessie the cow. She was donated to MIT, where she remains in the MIT Museum archives. She's also stuck with both Aaron and Larry in a less literal way. Here's Aaron.
Later, when I was a faculty member at MIT, we had this retreat, and there was apparently a small fiberglass calf nearby, and some of my students put it in the bed that I was using at this retreat as an acknowledgement of my pedigree, if you will.
And here's Larry.
Oh, it's definitely one of the central things I think about. Certainly this is the achievement, if you will, putting a capstone on something my senior year, for example. It's definitely one of the bigger things.
At the end of our conversation, we asked both Aaron and Larry what advice they had for MIT students who were contemplating hacks of their own. Aaron is now the dean of an engineering school, so that was a bit of a complicated question to answer.
You know, there's a very simple acid test, right? Like, can you explain to your mother why you decided to do this? And I think before you go ahead and do something that has the possibility that if it doesn't work out, the consequences could be pretty significant, you might want to reevaluate. But maybe that's the experience of no longer having most of my hair.
Larry, on the other hand, had a much simpler answer when we asked him for words of wisdom for MIT students currently contemplating a hack of their own.
Oh, absolutely do it. And the more innovative, the better.
Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast. This episode was written and reported by Ian Mont. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont, Elliot Adler, and me, Margot Gray. Our executive producers and story editors are Maddie Sprunkheiser and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is edited, mixed, and mastered by Chris Basil and Andy Jaskowitz. Special thanks to Jenna Weiss-Berman, J.D. Crowley, Leah Reese-Dennis, Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Kurt Courtney, Hilary Schuff, Sean Cherry, Laura Berman, and Hilary Van Ornum. Original theme music by James Waterman and Davey Sumner. If you have tips or story ideas, write to us at campusfilespod@gmail.com.